This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother stone. You better learn your past, you better learn young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
Murder of Mary Fagan, Part 6. We left off the last time talking about an article that was titled The Biography of Mrs. Lucille Selig Frank at leofrank.org. I want to finish up with a few thoughts further from this article. The very last thing I mentioned was that by 1913, the Selig clan were amongst the most prominent and respected Jewish families in Atlanta, Georgia. I'll have more to say about that in just a bit. Lucille and Leo Frank were married in 1910, just about 3 years, a little more than 3 years before the murder occurred. And what this article says, this is a pretty good paragraph I'll read here from that article. The evidence presented at the trial suggested Leo might have had an unhappy marriage with Lucille, especially because she had been barren during her three-year marriage to Leo, and lurid things were alleged to have gone on behind her back. In other twists and turns revealed during the trial and appeal, there were other accusations that painted Leo Frank as a sexually aggressive rake and mathematician playing the numbers game with a selection of his female employees, as in, quote, testing the waters, unquote, to see which ones might potentially be willing to engage in extracurricular activities. There were reports from the factory roustabout, Jim Conley, that described Leo Frank cheating on his wife at the factory with Atlantan prostitutes on various Saturdays. Conley recalls two incidents when he walked in on Leo Frank engaging in oral sex on two different Atlanta prostitutes at two different times. That's sort of an addendum to the last installment where I talked about this reputation of Leo Frank and why it was that it was suspected that he might have accosted Mary Fagan and ultimately murdered her. That this was part of the rationale behind it, behind that accusation, behind that suspicion. Now, Frank was buried after he was lynched. He was buried in New York, where his family was from. And that's important because his wife, Lucille, lived on for several decades. And later, when she died, I think it was sometime in the 1950s, I didn't write it down here, she never admitted that Leo Frank had ever admitted to her that he had killed Mary Fagan, as that black servant had testified or given her recounting of that conversation between Leo Frank that he had told his wife, according to this servant, that he had killed the girl and wanted his gun so that he could shoot himself. She had renounced that, the servant did. And Leo Frank's wife never admitted that that was true, that that conversation had ever happened. But what this article argues, and I agree with this point, is that Lucille, in her actions at her death, in a way lent credence to what that black servant had said, had claimed, which is that Leo Frank had confessed to his wife that he had actually committed the murder. And that for decades, the wife had simply set that aside and for the good of the tribe or whatever other reason, decided to try and stand with her husband and insist on his innocence. But when it came to her own death, that she requested cremation, and she requested that her ashes be dispersed in Atlanta rather than in New York, where Frank was buried. And this is important and notable because there was a space that the Frank family had set aside for Lucille to be buried, right next to Leo Frank. And there's a very poignant picture, a very emotionally moving visual argument as to Frank's guilt in a photo taken in modern day of the Frank burial site with that one missing headstone where Lucille should have been buried. And what the article concludes with, the last thing I'll read from it anyway, it says, from the perspective of the Jewish community, Lucille's quiet and controversial 1957 cremation was twofold unusual, especially for a faithful, proud, and practicing Jewess from a prominent and historically significant Jewish family. To go against the traditional practice of burial next to one's deceased spouse, or at the very least requesting to have her ashes buried or spread near her husband. So there were two points there that she thwarted or thumbed her nose at Jewish traditions. One is getting cremated, which Jews don't do ordinarily, and the other is not being buried next to her husband. While cremation was a very rare occurrence for Jews in the 1950s, it is now much more common in the 21st century, but still far from commonplace for prominent Jews. Now, I was curious about this family of hers. You know, the Frank family was from elsewhere, had lived in Texas for a while, lived in New York. But Lucille's family had lived in Georgia for a long time, according to this article. And so I had run into some background information about the Jews in Georgia. And Georgia itself, they were there at the very beginning, it seems. King George of England signed a charter establishing the colony in Georgia in 1732 and creating its governing board, which remained in England. And the first 114 Christian colonists arrived from England in February of 1733, so about a year later, a little less than a year. And then the first one to die in April, just 2 months later, was the colony's only doctor. And an article at GeorgiaEncyclopedia.org, specifically on Jews and Judaism, talks about how the first Jews came to Georgia. They arrived, a group of 42 men and women came on the schooner William and Sarah. They landed in Savannah in July of 1733, so just a few months after the Christian colonists had arrived and after the outbreak of a yellow fever there. It was James Edward Oglethorpe was the governor, I guess, or the leader of the Christian colony there, and he was surprised by the arrival of the new settlers. He didn't expect them. But at that point, he had not received instructions from the trustees, that's the governing board back in England, with regard to non-Christian colonists. But he was pleased to see amongst the group a physician, Samuel Nunez, who he later credited with saving many colonists who were ill with yellow fever. Oglethorpe cited his gratitude to the doctor among his reasons for assigning plots of land to 14 Jews. I went looking for this ship, the name of the ship, Googling for it, and I found a ship of the same name that had landed in Philadelphia, including passenger list, but it was in 1727. It wasn't the same ship. But ultimately, I stumbled across a wiki page. I wasn't even looking for Samuel Nunez, but it was his wiki page, and it's very interesting about Samuel Nunez. Now, he was considered the leader, the lead Jew of that group that landed first, or at least he became the leader, because it turned out that it was his skills that got them to be able to stay, that convinced Oglethorpe to to let them stay. And so this page on Nunez at Wikipedia is very interesting because it reveals that he was a Jew born in Portugal. They say he was a Portuguese physician amongst the earliest Jews to settle in North America. And that after the ship had landed, Captain Thomas Crane, one of General Oglethorpe's aides, wrote, quote, "Georgia will soon become a Jewish colony," unquote. Captain Crane feared that if this news leaked out, rich Christians would not support the colony and poor Christians would not settle there. The London trustees urged Oglethorpe to remove them. They had no legal basis for this request, as Georgia's charter permitted all persons, quote, "liberty of conscience in the worship of God," unquote, except Catholics. So that's a paragraph from the Wikipedia article on Nunez. A point to make here is that it's clear that everyone in authority except Oglethorpe, except the one man who had the final say, was against the Jews being able to settle there. They didn't want them. And it was Oglethorpe that overrode those recommendations. And I would guess that the Jews quite deliberately targeted him because they knew that he had it within his authority to do that. The article goes on to describe Nunez's background, and it says that the Nunez family, and it spells it in three different ways now. In the original Georgia Encyclopedia article, it spells it one way, N-U-N-E-S. The Wikipedia article is titled with N-U-N-E-Z, and then inside the article itself, it spells it N-U-N-I-S. So three alternate spellings, which is probably why in my initial searches I wasn't able to find this. But it makes it hard to find. But the article, the bulk of the article talks about the background of this family and how they were caught up in the Inquisition. And I thought to myself, well, the 1700s, the Inquisition happened hundreds of years before that. And this is one of those cases where it was a family of Jews who had escaped the Inquisition. The Inquisition had demanded of Jews that they either convert to Christianity or they leave Spain. And then ultimately, just a few years later, Portugal as well. So many of the Jews that had been in Spain fled to Portugal to escape this decision. Many fled to Amsterdam or Netherlands, and many fled to the Ottoman Empire, and many fled to the New World that was just being settled at the time. But some, at least, moved from Spain to Portugal, and this Nunez family apparently is one of those families that moved to Portugal, and then in Portugal pretended that they had converted to Christianity in order to stay. And probably it doesn't spell out here in the article, you have to read between the lines, but it's probably because they were very wealthy and wanted to keep their wealth, didn't want to liquidate it and move. It does mention that for many generations, this family kept up its Jewish faith in secret. One branch of the family living in Portugal was among the most distinguished of noble families, although it was a little more than 200 years after the expulsion from Spain, this family secretly still observed the Jewish religion. That is amazing, isn't it? That for 200 years, they married other Jews. They somehow recognized other Jews who were in the same situation and preferentially married them, and then kept their Jewish traditions inside their own household. Although on the surface, Dr. Nunez was as good a Catholic as any church-going Christian. Now, this is talking about when the doctor was still in Portugal, where he was born. The leaders of the Portuguese Inquisition took note of the warnings given to them by the doctor's enemies. They managed to smuggle an agent into the household of the Nunez family in the guise of a servant. Eventually, the agent reported that the Nunez family definitely was practicing the Jewish religion in secret. Every Saturday, they all retreated to a synagogue in an underground part of their mansion. Amazing, again. Now, it goes on as to how they escaped after they had been discovered and imprisoned. And the part about the escape is like a fairy tale. It reads like a children's story. So I don't put too much stock in this. I'll bet it was passed down word of mouth from Jew to Jew in that family, and that's how it reads anyway. But what's fascinating about it is that somehow, as if by a miracle, Nunez was able to get his whole family out and liquidate all of his assets before doing so, and then transfer them all to London via boat, which he hired in part from the money that he was able to get from liquidating his assets. Why he didn't do that hundreds of years earlier, I don't know. But so that was in the mid-1700s. It was they arrived in London in August of 1726. And then once in London, the article notes that Samuel and his sons underwent circumcision to identify themselves as Jewish openly. A few years later in 1733, now remember, 1733 is the year that the settlement, the Christian colonists first settled in Georgia, and a little later the Jews arrived there. So a few years later in 1733, the Nunez family was among several mainly Sephardic Jewish families from Portugal who left London for the colony of Georgia. Also joining them on the William and Sarah were a small group of Ashkenazi Jews with German origins. London Jews had been contributing liberally to the Oglethorpe scheme, by which I suppose they mean this trustee thing in the colony itself in Georgia, providing new homes for the impoverished Christians in the new colony of Georgia. Sure, just out of the goodness of their heart. In 1732, there were 6,000 Sephardic Jews living in London, having lived as crypto-Jews, publicly practicing Roman Catholicism, and secretly preserving their Jewish heritage. Prior to their departure from Portugal, the Bevis Marks Synagogue, still a Sephardic Jewish congregation in London today, helped finance the trip of their congregants. So that's who they were really financing, was other Jews. They weren't supporting Christians. But this is interesting to note here, that there were 6,000, at least according to this article that also contains other fairy tales, that 6,000 Sephardic Jews. So this Nunez family was by no means an individual outlier. It was thousands of Jews who had maintained their Jewishness for hundreds of years in Spain and Portugal, and then ultimately, or in Portugal anyway, and were then ultimately later, 200 years later, forced due to new pressure to leave. And they went to London at that time. And then from London, at least this handful of them, 40-odd, and elsewhere in the article it says that ultimately it was about 90 in that first year in two separate ships that landed in Georgia, where the other 6,000 went, I don't know. So that's what's interesting about that Wikipedia article about Samuel Nunez. Changed his name, by the way, from what it was originally in Portugal, but Samuel was new. Back to the Georgia Encyclopedia article now that I started with. It notes that 34 of the Jewish arrivals in 1733 were Sephardim, most having fled from Portugal to England, so corroborating what was in the Wikipedia article. The Ashkenazic, this is an interesting point, the Ashkenazic Jews, though, felt mistreated by the more numerous Sephardic Jews. Indeed, in 1734, an Anglican clergyman in Savannah noted that some Jews in Savannah complained that the Spanish and Portuguese Jews persecute the German Jews in a way no Christian would persecute another Christian. The internal feuding ended in 1741 during the War of Jenkins' Ear, when the Sephardim, fearing Spanish invasion, fled to Charleston, South Carolina, and New York, leaving only the Scheftel and Minnis families, both Ashkenazim, in Georgia. So just to reiterate for those who aren't familiar with the terms Sephardic and Ashkenazim, the Sephardic-type Jews are the Jews who had lived for many generations in Spain or Portugal, whereas the Ashkenazim were more Eastern European or Central European, either Germany or Poland, or even into Russia. And there was a culture clash, obviously. That's what this paragraph is talking about here, between the Ashkenazic Jews. And now, by all, just trying to judge from the description that's been provided here, that the Sephardic Jews had been living secretly, you know, suppressing their Jewishness for 200 years. But after 200 years, they were still confident enough in their Jewishness to oppress their Ashkenazic cousins and boss them around and so forth, and probably argue with them about what was the right interpretation of their holy laws and all of that. The Georgia Encyclopedia article goes on to talk about Atlanta's Jewish population, Atlanta being the biggest city in Georgia nowadays. But it's Atlanta's on the interior, whereas Charleston is Charleston, South Carolina, where the Jews first put in, must have been near the coast, and Savannah. It mentions that the city Savannah is on the coast of Georgia. So Atlanta's Jewish population, having been steered away from the farming by historical circumstances, Jews across Georgia, and it talks about how governments in Europe imposed restrictions on them owning land, apparently not enough to make them go away. But Jews across Georgia tended to gravitate toward non-agricultural work. Thus, the history of Georgia's Jews finds most of them clustered in the more urban areas, especially Savannah and Atlanta. The latter has become the center of Georgia's largest Jewish population. At the time of the Civil War, only 50 Jews lived in Atlanta. By 2000, the Jewish population had risen to 85,900. A little later, I'm skipping a bit here. Atlanta's fame and connection with its Jewish citizens centers on two incidents, both grievous examples of anti-Semitism and the marginalization of Jews by accepted white society in Georgia. And I'll just inject here to say that one of the two is what we're talking about in this series here, the Leo Frank trial, the murder of Mary Fagan. But in everything I've read so far, there is no other evidence of any marginalization of Jews. In fact, quite the opposite, that Jews were accepted grudgingly at the beginning, admittedly, but this idea that that there was grievous anti-Semitism or that the Leo Frank trial was an example, I'll have to do a whole installment dedicated to reviewing that issue after I do some research on it myself. But it mentions how the first issue of the first incident of anti-Semitism began with the trial and conviction of Leo Frank for the murder of Mary Fagan. Scholars, this is interesting, scholars generally agree today that Frank was almost certainly innocent of the crime. At the time, however, virtually all Georgians thought him guilty. That's typical of the kind of stuff that you read today, that scholars generally agree that Frank was almost certainly innocent of the crime. They don't, actually. It's Jewish scholars that agree that, and almost certainly innocent of the crime, based on nothing more than their own assertions, their own belief that that's what they want to believe, and so that's what they assert, that he was certainly innocent. In what I've seen of the case so far, I wouldn't assert certainty either way. I lean toward believing that Leo Frank was guilty, and in large part based on what virtually all Georgians thought at the time. I mean, if for no other reason, if you know nothing else about the case, if you were just a new arrival from Mars, that would be, I would think, the most important guiding principles. Well, what did the people at the time think? They knew what had happened best. The article, the Georgia Encyclopedia article, concludes or includes a paragraph about this commemorative plaque, and it's good to reiterate this too, that the Jews set up in Cobb County that marked where Frank was hanged. That's the plaque that reads, "Leo Frank, wrongly accused, falsely convicted, wantonly murdered." It's worth repeating that probably in every installment that I do, because that really sums up how Jews everywhere and across time have viewed the murder of Mary Fagan and the conviction of Leo Frank. Now, I have just a few minutes here, but I think I have enough to get into the meat of this, and maybe I'll finish it up the next time. But I had mentioned that article that I didn't like so much, that the one I started off here with, about the biography of Mrs. Lucille Selig Frank, because it was kind of rambling, and also the point was that it it talked about these confessions, these Leo Frank murder confessions, sort of out of the blue with no context to it. And I had seen that before, but I disagree with that terminology. I said that the rhetoric is understandable in its use, but it goes a little bit too far in implying that Frank actually confessed, which is a conscious thing. And I found, in looking for a little bit more about that, I found an article that actually seems to predate this later article about his wife. And it seems, I think it might have been written by the same person, because it touches on a lot of the same points. And it includes a list of these confessions, at least three of them. Later on, he must have come up with a fourth one. But I think it would be good to get to this. This is from an article titled 99 Years Ago, Did Leo Frank Confess? And it's at the National Vanguard website, which is run by Kevin Strom. And it was published in August of 2012, so a year before the anniversary of the murder and trial. And it's the author is signed Mark Cohen, so that immediately set off my warning bells in my head. I don't, the name Cohen is very Jewish, and I thought, well, is this even going to be worth reading? It was only because it was on the National Vanguard site that I bothered to even give it any credence. But it also seems to be that Mark Cohen is the administrator of leofrank.org. And so let me see if I can get to that. One of the points that that Mark Cohen mentions here that I'll add, because I've talked about it in previous installments, was Frank's testimony. It was not really sworn testimony. It was a 3 to 4 hour rambling, unsworn statement. And it couldn't even be explained to the jury why it was that everyone else at the trial got up and swore on the Bible to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, but not Frank. And there was no examination or cross-examination of Frank allowed after his statement. It was just a statement of that he wanted to make. And when I mentioned previously about Frank said this or Frank said that, that at least some of that comes from that 3 to 4 hour thing, including his statement about his possibly going to the bathroom at the scene of the crime, or where Mary Fagan was allegedly murdered. So there's that point about Mark Cohen's article, and I thought my interest was piqued by that point that I hadn't read elsewhere. It mentions, it goes then into that Frank in the bathroom business and mentions that Frank emphatically told the 7-man panel, the coroner's inquest, that he didn't use the bathroom all day long. And he makes a good point here. He says, it's as if Leo Frank was mentally and physically, albeit crudely and unbelievably, trying to distance himself from the bathroom, where Jim Conley later said that he found the body. So in other words, the argument is that Frank knew that he had killed the girl, and that's where he had killed her. And so that's why he came up with this unbelievable claim that he never went to the bathroom the whole day long. He was just sitting at his desk the whole time. And I thought that was a very interesting point. So that was worth repeating. Well, I guess I'll have to cover this, the rest of what I have to say about this, the next time. Out of time this time, but please join me that next time. And we'll get more into Mark Cohen and what Mark Cohen's background is, at least what's known about him on the internet.